from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Bay Area author Isabel Allende joins us to discuss her new novel, In the Midst of Winter. With locations spanning from Brooklyn to Guatemala, the story revolves around two very different people whose lives collide after a minor traffic accident and who are surprised to find love late in life. Allende has written more than 20 books and is the most widely read Spanish language author in the world. She'll join us in studio to talk about the book, and we'll hear about her foundation, which works to attain economic and social justice for women. It's coming up next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. A minor traffic accident during a winter storm in Brooklyn becomes the catalyst for a meeting between three very different individuals. In Bay Area author Isabel Allende's latest novel, In the Midst of Winter, her 23 books have been translated into 35 languages and have been made into two movies. And we're going to talk with her about her new book. We're also going to hear about her foundation, which works to enhance the power of girls and women around reproductive rights, economic independence, and freedom from violence. And amiga de mi vida, welcome, Isabel Allende.
Gracias, Michael. Gracias. It's wonderful to be here with you again.
Delighted to have you back again. let's begin by talking about your novel, though there's so much I want to cover with you in this hour. But it begins, as I said, with a traffic accident and moves us into three life stories and into a love story and so much more. A body in a trunk, so you've got a little bit of...
Oh, don't give it away!
some mystery. I just want to add mystery. I didn't say what the body was doing in the trunk.
No.
but I want to get into just the capriciousness of that. You know, it's a stormy night and winter night, and because of the weather conditions, it moves the whole plot forward. And that is sort of so often the mystery of life. Something like that can move everything forward in life.
Yeah, things do happen that change our lives completely. I think that the whole book could be summarized in the quote by Albert Camus that says, "In the midst of winter, I finally found in me an invincible summer." And I think that sentence struck a chord in me when I read it and put the book together, because also it happens during a metaphorical real storm, which is a huge blizzard that we had in New York last year in January. And so between the quote and the blizzard, I got the story.
And the love story figures into that and in the title, because in the winter of one's life, and I went back and heard some of your TED Talks, and you talk about, let me quote you, "I'm sure you can fall in love exactly as you did at 20, absolutely certain, whatever age you may be."
I think so. And I have experienced it. Look, Michael, I'm 75 and I'm madly in love, as I was when I was 17. The only difference is that you have a sense of urgency, that there's no time to waste. That you really
I've never
have
known
to
you to
up.
Waste time, even in your more salad days, in your younger days. But you have these three characters and you bring them together and their stories are so different. And one is in Guatemala and one is in Brazil and... and one is in Chile, and yet there's a sense of just the human community and the universality of their stories.
They are all traumatized people.
They're all victims, really, yes.
They're not victims. They have had traumatized past, all of them, for different reasons. And they are living in a sort of emotional winter in which nothing quite happens. But then, because they are forced to make a decision, either back off of a certain situation that is dangerous and risky, or just opt for solidarity, for compassion, for adventure, a sense of curiosity about life. And when they do that, everything changes for them. And I think that they have in common a lot. When you talk about having humanity in common, that's what I have found, that through my foundation and the work I do and the books I write, people are similar, Michael. We all feel more or less the same. We all feel love and hatred and fear or jealousy or solidarity the same way. In every part of the world, it's the same. And maybe that's why my books work in translation, because in Finland or in Vietnam, people want the same things and they fear the same things.
Although I always think, when I think of universality, yeah, that there are good people and bad people, and most of us somewhere in between the two. But you seemed hesitant about the word victims, but the stories bring out, well, poverty and trauma, certainly, but also torture and rape, gangs and murder and so forth, coyotes, yeah. I mean, the kind who...
The smugglers.
The smugglers. I mean, there's a lot of victimization.
Yes, but when I say that I hesitated with the word victim, it's because victim is someone that stays in that place of being disempowered. And because I work with empowering women and girls, I know that you can get out of that state of being a victim with some help and become and use whatever has happened, the trauma, the sorrow, the pain, use it to become stronger and sometimes become leaders.
I'm going to ask you a question that always occurs to me when I talk to people who do the kind of extraordinarily altruistic work like you do. Why care? I mean, you care deeply, especially about the plight of women. You care about refugees. It comes across in the book. You care about the undocumented and so forth. You have made a lot of your life and a lot of your fortune toward those. Why do that?
Why not? I mean, why not, Michael? If my daughter used to say, you only have what you give. You only have what you share. I mean, what do you have, Michael? You have a voice. You have a stand in the community. Why? Because you share your experience, your knowledge, your voice, your programs, your guests. If you kept all that for yourself, you would have nothing. And I feel the same way. I feel that I have stories to tell. And by sharing my stories, I get a lot back. If I have, through the foundation, I do some work, it's true, but I get so much more back. I mean, I can't even begin to tell you. All these stories that you read in my books, I've heard them. I enhance them a little. I mix them up. But the raw material is there.
I think you said in the TED Talk that nothing feels better than doing for others. And that, I think,
service
is the answer to a great extent. I just asked you because I was curious to know how you would respond. But you responded in a way that was completely consonant with what I connect with you. But I also connect you with the memory of your daughter, which is very important in this work you do. Paula.
Yeah. Paula is like my spiritual guide in a way. When I'm in doubt, I think, what would she say? And she would say, Mom, stop it. Let go. She would say, Mom, what is the most generous thing to do in this case? That's the kind of stuff she would say. So it's easy. With four or six of those sentences, I get along really well with people and in the world.
We're talking with Isabel Allende about her new novel, In the Midst of Winter. A lot of people probably don't know about the story of your daughter. It's one of the books you wrote after she passed. Tell us a little more about her.
Well, Paula was a wonderful human being, and she got married and was living in Spain with her new husband, recently married. And she had a condition called porphyria that doesn't need to be fatal. But she went to the hospital. They gave her the wrong medication. She fell in a coma. They didn't monitor the coma. And they gave me back my daughter with severe brain damage in a coma. And this was before 9/11. And I was able to bring Paula in a United flight, commercial flight, all the way from Madrid to San Francisco, connecting flights in Washington. Can you imagine if that would be possible today? No way. No way. And I got my daughter in this country without a visa or a tourist visa on a stretcher with a nurse and took care of her at home until she died. She died in December 6, 1992.
And the grief was paralyzing for a while.
Write a book, and I wrote a sort of memoir of what had happened and a memoir of my life and her life. And that was very healing. It put things in place, in perspective. Sometimes grief can take over all your life, and it seems that everything is just dark. Until you, well, in my case, when I write it, I can put it in boxes. I can say, well, this is what happened in this case. This happened here. But I have my grandchildren, and there is life, and there is love, and there's... So I can handle it better. I don't let it take over my life completely.
And there's food, and there, because you did write that book about food after you came out of the immobility, and animals. And animals play an important role once again in this novel.
In most of my books, I have weird animals. They are not normal animals.
I never expected to meet a moose, though.
In Ripper, I had a war dog that was a Belgian Malinois deaf because of the bombs, and he had titanium fangs. In this one, I have a crazy Chihuahua that has protruding eyes because they don't quite fit in the sockets, and because he has no teeth, his tongue is hanging. Actually, that Chihuahua called Marcelo, I know him. He's a real character. He belongs to a wonderful young woman who came to do an internship in the foundation.
We've also got four cats, right?
Yeah, four cats.
Why Brooklyn?
Well, because I know Brooklyn. I was in Brooklyn. I've been going to Brooklyn every year for the holidays because my daughter-in-law, whom I adore, Lori, is from Brooklyn, and her family, an extended Italian-Sicilian family, is from there. And so we always rent a house and stay for the holidays there. And I was there when the idea of the book came to be.
We were speaking with Isabel Allende about her new novel, In the Midst of Winter, and also talking with her about a number of other things, including, let me bring up passion, because, as I said, I went back and listened to your TED Talks, and passion plays a very preeminent role in this novel. I remember Isaac Babel, the Russian writer, said, passion rules the universe. Could that fit your picture of the universe?
Probably, yes, probably. I relate passion to enthusiasm, to energy, to zest for life, and it doesn't have to be romantic necessarily. It's passion for everything you do, to do it wholeheartedly.
And you have passion when you write. It comes across when you talk. Those two don't necessarily conform for many writers. I mean, you know, you're a performer as a storyteller, but you're also a performer often when you come on the show or when you give these TED Talks and so forth. There are a lot of writers who are very shy and don't come out of that lone.
Well, I started like you, Mike, like in journalism. So that gives you a very good training.
Yeah, wasn't it, if memory serves me and it doesn't so well as it used to, I think it was Pablo Neruda who said, you should be a fiction writer.
Yeah, because I lie all the time. Why would I be a journalist? I can't even stick to the truth.
You could say that about, a lot of that has been said about our president.
I know.
But he's not a fiction writer. I don't even think he's a fiction
reader.
Maybe
that's what he should do, go back to entertainment.
You think?
Yeah, that would be great.
We're talking again with Isabel Allende. Some of the women that you profile in these talks you gave, including Wangari Maathai, who won a Nobel Prize, who I've had the privilege of interviewing, but other women who are just so courageous and so resilient.
Yeah, that's why I don't like the word victim, because I know women like them. The case of Rose Mapendo, for example, that I've mentioned.
It's a woman from the Congo?
Yeah. That I mentioned in one of the TED Talks. She survived horrors and was able to save 9 children. She gave birth to premature twins in a starving death camp in Congo. And she was rescued by this incredible organization, Refuge Point. And she has a life, and all her kids have survived wonderfully and thrived. So is she a victim? She was a victim at a certain point, but that doesn't define her as a person. What defines Rose Mapendo and many other women that I know and that are the models for my books is that, yeah, they suffer horrible situations, and they get back on their feet.
Say something about, and you know, it used to be the role of the novelist to, particularly after writing a story like your novel, to talk about the issues that are raised in the novel. And you raise issues about the undocumented. You raise issues about torture going on in Latin American countries and so many of the issues that have to do with what refugees are displaced from. And most of the refugees, as you point out, are women.
Women and children.
And children, yeah. families that are broken up. But you know, I also heard you say, "I want to make this world good," and
that's very ambitious.
It's very ambitious, but it shows the passion you have and what is so admirable about the work you're doing here in this foundation. And I remember when you also had a foundation for literacy, worked with you on that. But there's a whole sense of the suffering in all of this, and how much can we really do? I mean, especially with the refugee problem, you know, how sustainable can it be for us to keep taking people into European countries or into the United States and so forth? There are millions who have been displaced.
Millions. In this book, I have the case of a young Guatemalan woman who has been raped and tortured in Guatemala by the gangs. I mean, some countries in Central America are taken over by gangs and narcos and corrupt police, and they have experienced war against the poor and war against the indigenous people. So they are traumatized in many ways. Why people leave what is familiar to them, all what they know, their families, their country, their language, their homes, to cross the sometimes miles and miles to get to a place where they will probably be received with hostility. It's because they are risking their lives if they stay. You don't do something like that unless you're desperate. And because I have been a political refugee, I can understand that very easily. And I've also been an immigrant, a Latina immigrant. So I know what it feels like. And I know that we cannot keep taking in immigrants. But the world is a very unfair place, Michael, in which money, drugs, guns, corporations are global. They don't know borders. Only people do, only workers, because the rich people don't either. They are jet-set international. It's the poor. It's the desperate. And so those people are the ones who look for refuge. There were no Syrian refugees a few years ago, and now there are millions of them in Europe. Why is that? Because the conditions in their country change so dramatically, they can't survive there.
The violence and war drive them out.
So we have to solve the problems where they are originated. We have to try to solve the problem in Syria if we don't want more Syrian immigrants in Europe. We have to try to solve the problem in Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, before we build a wall. Because the wall won't stop the desperate people from coming in. Again, or knocking at the wall, which is just as bad.
Talking with Isabel Allende about her new novel, In the Midst of Winter. How important is it for a novelist to be political, as you are? Especially if they write about these issues.
I don't think it's particularly important, because many writers are not. But in my case, I come from Latin America. It's almost impossible for a Latin American writer to be separated from the social circumstances in which we live. So As a Latin American citizen, I was involved in social and political issues in reform, let's say, in an organic way. You cannot ignore it. It's part of life. It affects your life.
Well, when you left Chile, you went to Venezuela, and now I'm interested to hear what you have to say about Venezuela, because things have become catastrophic.
Catastrophic. It's absolutely terrible. And the only thing that we can do is just hope that things will be solved without more violence, because it's become a terrible place.
Well, what do you attribute that to? I mean, a lot of people think that Chavez had things under control, but, you know, certainly it has a lot to do with petroleum, and it has a lot to do with, I'm sorry to say, American involvement in one way or the other.
And it has to do with bad government and bad management. Socialism is a wonderful idea in abstract, like capitalism is, but they don't work when you apply them really fully, as they've done in Venezuela, or as we are doing here with capitalism. These are political ideas that were created more than a century ago, and we are still applying it. Our democracies are not functioning, because I think they have to be adjusted to the new times that we are living. If you think about it, when did Marx write about Marxism? When did the Soviet Union apply communism? It's a long time ago. And now that doesn't work. And here, capitalism, our pure capitalism, is a disaster.
Susan Sontag once said they're the same.
It's the same on the practically. And then you have an elite of people who own too much, indecent elite. And then you have an impoverished mass of people that is getting poorer and poorer and angrier. That doesn't work either.
You speak out politically and economically and socially, but you also, in many ways, speak out philosophically. I think it was Heraclitus who said, fate is character, and then Sal Bello reversed it and said character is fate. But you say it's our heart that drives us, that determines our fate. The heart more than the head, the heart more than anything else?
Yeah, because we do things because of the heart. Why do we go to war, really, for example? Why do we fall in love? Why do we risk our lives like the firemen do to save a pet in a burning house? We don't think. It's just the heart that pulls us or pushes us. And we forget when we live in the brain with ideas, with concepts, abstract concepts, we are shocked by reality. And I think this is what happened with Trump. And it's a perfect example of the... The election. I mean, we have never had a better candidate, a more prepared person for the job than Hillary Clinton. And everybody assumed that she would be the president. And that was the brain, reason, facts. And then Trump gets elected. And that is a visceral reaction from the heart and the gut of people who voted for him. And we never contemplated that.
Talking with Isabel Allende. I'm talking about her new novel and a range of other topics. The new novel is called In the Midst of Winter. And let's get you, our listeners, involved in this conversation. It is a wide-ranging conversation. We'd like to hear your thoughts and like to hear certainly any questions you have for the eminent writer who is here with us. I know many of her readers are listening, and so feel free to join the program. Talking about refugees, about the undocumented, about, victimization and whether that word is even advisable, and so many other things. Please feel free to join the program, and let me tell you a number of ways that you can do that forthwith. Our toll-free number is available to you, and you can join us now. 866-733-6786 is the number for your calls. And again, we welcome them, so please feel free to be interactive in the program. It's 866-733-6786. Or email questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, or go to our Facebook page. Many ways that you can become involved in the conversation and join the program, and we do invite you to do that. Isabel Allende, our guest, her new novel, In the Midst of Winter. You're listening to Forum on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Isabel Allende, talking about many things, as I said, including her new novel, In the Midst of Winter. And we do invite your involvement in the program. You can become part of the program by calling us at 866-733-6786 or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. And we were talking before about, you know, in the midst of winter, falling in love at a later age, and you've said you're madly in love now. I'm happy to hear that. And love, as you said, can come at any age, but is it really the same as it was, you know, at 20? It's got to be different in so many ways because you've aged, yeah? I mean, not only physically, but the experiences of life and so forth shape your character, make you different.
I think that we become more, we become clearer with age. We know what we are not going to put up with. We know what we want. We don't compromise so much. And we don't play games. No, there's no time for little games, for little jealousies. There's no time for that. So you have to be very truthful, very honest, willing to take risks, and know that you have little time left. And that that creates a state of mind that is like, I find it very interesting because it's like when I was a teenager, I couldn't be separated for a minute from the boy I was in love with. And now I feel the same way, but for different reasons. It's not hormonal so much as it is, as it is the certainty that death is waiting for me out there.
Wherever out there may be. I mean, you wonder the proximity when you say out there. I do, at least. Anyway, I've been thinking lately, it seems that getting a little long in the tooth, and I'm thinking to myself, this is a pre-mortem state. You know, this is the last runner on the track, maybe. I don't mean to be morbid about it, but it's just a recognition of the reality of it.
Of course. And so you have to enjoy, if you have health, if you have energy, if you have resources, enjoy them, because all that's going to be gone.
There's also something I wanted to discuss before we go to our calls with you. You're talking about what's real and what's being able to determine more what's real and so forth. As you age, there's also the sense of fiction having a reality. And I know you've talked about this, that fiction is a gateway not only to truth, but in some ways that fiction can be a vehicle of greater truth. Or even though fiction means made up and lies, like you said, like Pablo Neruda accused you of being a liar, but the lies create truth.
Well, in fiction, at least the fiction I try to write, there is reality, and you fictionalize it to get it to the reader so that the reader can feel it in the heart. If I talk about the plight of refugees in Bangladesh today, it's numbers. Unless you hear the story of one woman whose baby was taken away from her arms and burnt alive. And then you realize that baby could be yours. That woman, I could be that woman. So fiction has that incredible power of putting the reader in the center of the action, in the heart of the character, in the skin of the character. And you become the character and you feel it in ways you don't feel it otherwise. And so that's why I feel that fiction has that power to take the reader there, but to take me there also. I cannot write about it if I'm not there truly.
I wonder, you know, it's easy to identify with the male character in your book because, you know, there are things with which I identify. but it may be harder in some ways to identify with people not only of a different gender, but also who come from a different national background, despite the universality. So how do you get into that taproot of, again, the universal nature of human experience?
Well, usually the characters are based on some real people that I know, that I have met, that I have talked to. The best research is talking to people who have experienced that. So we have cases in our foundation very similar to the case of Evelyn Ortega in the book, worse cases that I can't write about them because it would be unbelievable and the reader would just shut off. But I also know people like Lucia. I have models for Lucia, so I can really be her for a while I write about her. And certainly, if I have a male character, I look for a model because it's harder for me to create a male character than a female.
Well, so who was there a model for Richard, the male character?
I have two. I have a very good friend that is adorable, and I have my brother, Juan. And they are both these cautious people that are afraid of taking risks. They want the world to be safe, and the world will never be safe. So they are always caught off guard.
Talk just a moment. We'll go to your calls here. But you've written memoirs, and you've done something that, frankly, I respect. You've asked some of the people that you portray in the memoirs to read and approve or disapprove of what you would write about them, whereas in fiction you can hide all kinds of things and conceal, so it gives you a different, whole different medium. But I think it was Paul Auster who once said to me that the difference between writing a memoir and writing a work of fiction is you're in a different state of consciousness when you write a novel. When you're in a fiction, when you're in a memoir, you're just like sorting things in a desk drawer that were there for a long time. But in many respects, you have to also respect the fact that you're writing about people in ways that can expose them, reveal them.
I have written memoirs with the same state of mind that I use in fiction. They are stories to me. And I I feel that I own the stories. But of course, when the manuscript is ready, I have to show it to those people that are named in the book, because they need to know that this is happening. And I have done this with both memoirs, and I only once got a person who didn't want me to portray him that way, and I took him out of the book. I couldn't change it, but I took him out.
What would you say to someone like Nuala O'Fallon, the Irish writer who I interviewed years ago, who said, now deceased, but who said to me, in effect, I don't ask permission. It's coming from me. It's my perceptions. And if they don't like the way they're portrayed, too bad.
I wouldn't say that so bluntly.
I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah, but, because you don't want to hurt people. And then there are stories that really don't belong to you. They're very personal stories that if you don't have permission to write about it, well, maybe you shouldn't.
Members of her family stopped talking to her.
But for example, in The House of the Spirits, most of my family is portrayed in that book, but it's fiction. I didn't have to ask permission. If I had written that book as a memoir, it started almost as a memoir, a letter to my grandfather. If I had continued as a letter to my grandfather, I don't think I would have been able to publish that. But because it was fiction, I could say whatever I wanted.
Still writing letters prolifically to your mother?
Every single day, sometimes twice a day.
They should be collected probably one day.
I have a full room of boxes, plastic boxes. Every year I put the letters that she writes and the ones I write in a plastic box. And we have calculated that there are between 600 and 800 letters per box. And there are several decades
big boxes.
Of boxes.
I'm going to go to the calls here. I'm looking at a listener question, though, and as long as we've been friends, this question has never come up. I've never asked it of you in interviews. Does Isabel believe in God?
I believe in spirit. I believe that we are much more than the material world that we perceive, and that there is mystery. But I'm not a religious person. So my life is guided by certain moral principles that probably my grandfather instilled in me. But I don't think of God. I don't think of... But I do believe that there is a transcendence and spirituality.
One comment, and then we'll go to your calls. Miriam writes, please tell Isabel I love her work and have read every book she's written. I appreciate her heart-based, compassionate approach to current issues, including the international refugee crisis.
Thank you.
Let's bring in some calls. Let's go first to Hannah. Hannah, you're on the air.
Hi, Isabel. You're my favorite writer, and I just love everything you write for decades. So thank you so much for your generosity, for keeping writing. Like every time you come out with a new novel, I'm just like, yay, she did it again.
So thank you so much. Thank you so much.
And what I was wondering is, because you're my favorite writers, who are your favorite writers? So I could be advised that way.
My favorite writer is me.
You.
I write the books I like to read.
Right. Is there anyone else that you enjoy
Of course, 1,000. I get to read new books by new writers, old books by old writers, and I research a lot. So sometimes I stumble upon wonderful books that I should have read decades ago, and then I'm reading now. For example, now I'm researching about the Civil War in Spain, and I get to read classics that I had not read before.
And you did a lot of research for this book too, obviously.
Yes, I did research, but it was easy research because it's contemporary. Everything happens now. So it's much easier to find the people you need to talk to. When I have written historical novels, you have to trust on documents and maybe letters written at the time, but it's always iffy.
Do you have a preference? I mean, in terms of writing a historical novel as opposed to this, which is more, well, a novel of contemporary personal stories.
This is a new venue for me. I wrote The Japanese Lover and this one, In the Midst of Winter, that I was writing as the events were happening, the same year. And it was fascinating because it keeps the book moving at a fast pace. Yeah, I started In the Midst of Winter on January 8th, 19. I mean, excuse me, 2016.
Always the same day.
Always the same day. By that time, Trump wasn't even a candidate. We were not talking about immigration as we are talking now, but these things were in the air. And I could maybe feel them at a certain level, and that's why one of my characters is an undocumented immigrant or refugee. In this case, she's a refugee. I was writing about love, mature love, because my characters are in their 60s, long before I met Roger. So there's a prophetic element in fiction.
Was Roger, like Richard, maybe protecting his heart?
Of course. A life that was made of routines, very safe, nothing happened. And then this Latin American hurricane falls on his head and he's forced to change everything.
Hurricane Isabel. Yeah. It fits. Let me get another caller on with us, and that's Neil. Neil, you're on.
Yeah. Have you ever written or said anything about human rights violations in Cuba? A lot of people on the left refuse to write about any human rights violations in left-wing countries. And one more question. What's your opinion of Graham Greene?
Oh, thank you. Yes, I have not written about human rights abuses in Cuba, although I am aware of them, absolutely, as I have not written about human rights abuses in many, many places. But being a lefty doesn't make me blind, as I am very clear about what's happening in Venezuela, or very clear about what happens in Cuba. And I used to read Graham Greene when I was much, much younger. I haven't read him for ages, and I loved it.
Let me thank Neil for the call. And again, Isabel Allende's new novel is called In the Midst of Winter, and we're talking to her about the novel as well as about many other things, including things related to the refugee crisis and to undocumented workers who live here as the character in her novel. In fact, things are set in motion because she gets in this car accident and she's undocumented and presents some
problems. Well, people who are undocumented live in fear. Right now, many of the houses that were burnt in the fires here in California belong to very, very humble workers, undocumented, that feel that they have no rights. They were not willing to leave their houses because they feared that they would be arrested. And then they don't go to the shelters because they fear that they will be deported. They have no safety of any kind. And they have always the fear of being deported or arrested. I mean, it's very hard to live like that.
Another caller joins us. Tom, welcome. You're on the air.
During the election for president, Hillary Clinton thankfully and gratefully accepted the endorsement of Henry Kissinger. And I immediately thought of Isabel Allende and wanted to know what she would think.
Well, I despise Kissinger, and he was instrumental in toppling the government in my country and the assassination of Salvador Allende, the president, as the United States, under his lead, intervened in many, many countries and replaced legal democracies by dictatorships. And the worst human rights abuses, atrocities of all kinds, were committed at that time.
You know that Christopher Hitchens wrote a book that made a case for the prosecution of Henry Kissinger. In fact, I featured it on Forum. Said he should be arrested as soon as they're able to do so, like they did with Pinochet when he was in Europe or something. Yeah, you agree?
Yes.
Yeah. Let me thank the caller. Say your audience is getting younger as you get older. How does that work?
I have no idea. And people are getting taller also. Not only younger, but more beautiful and taller. I keep looking up at people. The only thing I see is nostrils. It's terrible, Michael.
Listener wants to know, does Allende write differently if she does it in Spanish or in English? Is her inspiration different?
I write only in Spanish, and I have very good translators. The translators improve my books dramatically.
Actually, your agent of many years died not that long ago, right?
No. My agent died, yeah, Carmen Balcells.
But the same translators.
But my first translator was Margaret Sawyer Peden, and she is still alive, but she doesn't work anymore. She's retired, and now I have other translators that are really good.
Happy with your translators? Happy with the movies that have been made of your novels?
And yes.
Happy with the new agent?
My new agent is Carmen Balcells' son, who was a sort of ignored by his mother and very quiet, and he didn't make any noise in his life until his mother died suddenly. She was found dead in her bathroom, and he took over the business, and he's doing a splendid job. He's none of the authors have left him, and he's doing a very, very good job. And no one was expecting that. You know, it's a big surprise.
So let me ask you, if you had the powers of the executive of this government and even had the Congress behind you and everything, what would you do about the so-called refugee crisis? I mean, we have people, we talked about millions in Syria. There are hundreds of thousands who want to come up across the border. And, you know, our president wants to build a wall. But what to do about letting them in when we can?
Well, it has to be organized in some way. You have to let them in legally. And as we did before, I mean, this country was formed with immigrants. And the immigrants that came to this country came, they were welcome in a certain form, and they came to work and to build the country. We can still do that. This is a huge country, and we have the capacity to do it. Or we can also have...
But our resources are limited, right? I mean, in terms of...
If all resources everywhere are limited... But immigrants come to the country and improve the resources. They don't take away anything. It has been proven historically and economically that they are not a burden.
I've seen those research studies, and they're impressive in terms
they're
of what they offer and what they contribute.
But,
I'm just talking about the sheer numbers, though, the scale.
The sheer numbers can be controlled. And try to remember that no one wants to leave their own country. So if we improve the conditions in each country... things improve. The biggest number of immigrants today come from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Not so much from Mexico anymore. And why is that? Because that's called the Triangle of the North. The worst violent life in the planet that is not at war. There is a beautiful TED Talk by Sonia Nazarios, the one who wrote, the journalist that wrote that impressive book called Enrique's Journey, that she follows that boy that crosses crosses Mexico to come to the United States looking for his mother. And that book is a classic. And she has a TED Talk. Please try to listen. Sonia Nazarios. And it's about how you can stop the immigration crisis by keeping people safely in their own places, and if needed, giving them work permits so that they can come, work, and leave. Nobody wants to stay. They want to go back to their villages, to their families.
What about the undocumented who are here? I mean, who people on the right, including the present administration, those in the present administration, people like Steve Bannon, say they came here illegally, they should be sent back.
Are you going to deport 11 million people? How are you
impossible.
Going to do that?
Impossible.
That is impossible.
But what would you do?
And it's also a humanitarian crisis. Are you going to separate families, leave babies behind because they were born here and send their mothers back to Guatemala? I mean, give me a break.
What about amnesty?
We have done amnesty before, and it has worked. We've done it with Nicaragua. We've done it with many, many places. Why not? What's the problem? This country can take so much more. We are so powerful, so vast. We have so much territory. There's work for everybody.
By the way, Amanda, who is splendid in these kind of situations, has just informed me on my iPad that she's put up the link of the Sonia Nazario TED Talk on our website, kqed.org/forum.
Please watch it.
In the meantime, let's hear what some listeners have to say or ask. Jose, you're on the air.
Yes. Buenos días, good morning, Michael. Thank you for your great programming. And Mrs. Isabel, muchísimas gracias de todo corazón for...
Gracias, Jose.
For your literature, your knowledge, your sensitivity, and your honesty. About 30 years ago, I lost my older sister and overdosed on heroin in Los Angeles. And my mother, you know, I call her a walking angel. It was very important to read your book on Paula and pass it to her. And we want to thank you so much for that. And I always purchase all your books in Spanish first because I knew you wrote them in Spanish. And And it's a blessing to have you here on this side of the
Jose, we could call Isabel talks about being Hurricane Isabel, but we could call her a walking angel too, I think.
Well, definitely. Gracias, Jose.
And I'm from Nicaragua and was there during the whole Sandinista revolution. Yeah. And I also want to thank all your perspective and your spoke. You speak for so many of us here in this country.
Gracias, thank Jose. You. Muchas gracias.
Thank you, Jose, for the call. And here's Alfonso. Alfonso, welcome. Bienvenidos.
Buenos dias. Isabel, this is Alfonso Valenzuela Gumucio. I'm an extremely love all your books, and especially The House of the Spirits. But my mother was Salvador Allende.
I'm sorry?
Buenos dias.
Alfonso, did we lose you? You were in the middle of a sentence.
You were saying something about Salvador Allende?
Oh, Salvador Allende, he was my mother's godfather, and I always been very related to the Allende family for that respect. My grandmother was extremely good friends with them, and I just wanted to tell you how much I love all your books.
Gracias. Yeah. Muchas gracias. Alfonso.
Kind of you, Alfonso. Thank you for the call. You are kind of a rock star. I mean, I've been at events with you where people from backgrounds like the last two callers we've heard, but people who are very much Americans and everything come to give you this kind of tribute and so forth. How do you keep your humility?
Oh, I'm not humble at all. I'm terribly arrogant.
Yeah, no.
I'm vain.
But you also have a modesty about you that you maintain.
Look, all this celebrity thing happens in an outer circle. It doesn't really touch my life. I'm sure it doesn't touch yours, Michael. I mean, you're a celebrity also. I mean, everywhere you go, people know you. Does it make you feel different about yourself?
No.
No.
But celebrity would be there aren't that many people in radio who are really celebrities.
You know,
it's like the word victim. It doesn't quite fit. Yeah.
I have a friend who says that he doesn't want, when he takes a shower, he wants a lot of steam and doesn't want the steam to get out of the bathroom so he doesn't have to look at himself in the mirror. And I think that is a splendid metaphor for how I feel about my life. I just don't want the steam to get out and look at myself truly. I don't know. I come to do things in the world and share them. That's it.
But you do lead with your heart and always have.
Well, because I have very little brains.
Come on. Now, that's false modesty. We were talking before about the fact that you always begin your books on the same date. Why is that? Is that superstition, maybe?
No, it's discipline, Michael. I mean, you come here every
better
day.
You
come at a certain hour every day. You don't procrastinate. I don't either. And being a writer means that I don't have a boss that is telling me when to do something or how. So I have a day to start, and I'm very disciplined when I start a book, always on January 8th. Can you imagine what January 7th looks like in my life?
But you do have a boss. I think Freud called it the superego.
The superego, the drill sergeant.
The conscience that's driving you what makes you want to write.
But also that every day. I mean, every day I set aside a number of hours to work.
You also once said that storytelling is like an ear for music. You either have it or you don't have it.
I believe that. Yeah. I think that anybody can become a writer. Some people, very good writers, because that's a skill. That's something, a craft that you learn. But the ear, the instinct for suspense, for rhythm, for tone, for who is the narrative voice, for what is the highlight of the story, how do you end it? It's like a person who can tell a joke. You can tell jokes. I know all your jokes, but I can't tell them.
If you know all of them.
I can't tell them. And it's an instinct. You're born with it or you're not.
There's an art to it, though. I mean, and a craft to it as well, despite all the instinctual drive that may be a part of it.
Most people in the world cannot tell a joke, and you can. So what's that? Isn't that an ear?
I wanted to be a novelist, as you well know. And I think if Terry Gross once said, because she also wanted to be a novelist, I didn't hear those voices. That's a good way to put it in some ways. You either hear the voices, you have the instinct, you hear like the music, you hear it.
And well, I think I don't hear the voices exactly, but I hear something that is in the air. And it coincides with something that is happening or something that is really an obsession in my life that I need to explore. Why do I write a novel about the slave revolt in Haiti that has nothing to do with me culturally? We didn't have plantations in Chile. We didn't have African slaves. Why would I spend 4 years of my life researching, half of it in French, about that?
And a lot of it's just your curiosity, isn't it?
But why curiosity for that particular event and not another?
And your answer is?
I was obsessed with the idea, and I still
obsession.
Am. Obsessed with the idea of absolute power with impunity. And that is the power of the master over the slave. And the atrocities that we can commit when we have that kind of power is horrible.
It's also the power of the Duvaliers, as long as we're talking about Haiti. Not only the master-slave, but and that was really the core of that book, but also what became the government and what is the government in many countries.
And the extreme power of police with impunity, of fathers with impunity, of governments with impunity. We were talking about governments that don't work, that have absolute power, and they have impunity. So beware, citizens, beware.
Beware, and siempre mucho gusto hablando con tú.
Gracias, gracias, Michael.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. Again, Isabel Allende's new novel is In the Midst of Winter. We'll be back with you if all goes according to plan on tomorrow. Stay tuned. This is KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.